Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Today's show. My name is Mark Kohler. I hope we've got a good reception here. I'm hoping Lisa in the studio can confirm that. We've kind of got a weird connection here. I'm broadcasting live from Cedar City, Utah, the home office, and excited about what we've got on for the show today. It's the Open Forum show. Excited to be with you, and hope that many of you find this to be a rewarding and helpful show. Exciting times. So it's windy as usual here in Cedar City. So that may be causing some of the difficulties, but hopefully everything sounds good on your end. We hope so. So maybe Lisa, pop on here from the studio and let me know how it's sounding. If you can give us a quick yay or nay. Well, okay. Well, we may have some issues here. So give us a moment here while we're dealing with some technical difficulties. Not hearing from Lisa here. One moment. So we're looking good. Okay. Well, welcome, everybody. A few technical difficulties. We are rocking now, so we're sounding good. All right. So anyway, got the tax day over with, folks, right? So happy tax day. Time to move on, right, and start another year of making money, and hopefully some of your tax, tax day now? I should have looked it up, but it's brutal to know how much of our income it takes us during the year to earn before we pay off our tax bill. Number one cost in life. So we're here talking about ways to save taxes, build wealth, protect our assets. Thank you if you're one of our new listeners. Glad you're here. Apologize for that clunky start, but last week we celebrated the 400th live show. So I promise you that we've got it down to a science generally, just a few blips once in a while here. So anyway, if some of you have a chance to look at the newsletter this week, you had another round of great blog articles, some videos, please check it out. Matt Sorensen announced his new IRA video series. So this is kind of self-directed IRA six-part videos. Series, very affordable, $150. Watch the videos over and over, and Matt is going to be uploading more videos in the future. So if you haven't had a chance, click on the link there on the newsletter to see about Matt's self-directed IRA training. For any of you that are self-directing, you'll find these videos very, very helpful, from basic to the complex. Also, I have a little weekly message. Try to give a little weekly message in the newsletter. Some of you maybe had a chance to look at it and read it in detail. Talked about owning a small business on the side. Many of you listening to the show are obviously entrepreneurs, but if you're not yet, or you're just embarking on that venture, I want to encourage you to keep an open mind. Doesn't mean we have to quit our job or change our careers dramatically, but just have a little something on the side to help us build a little extra wealth, some revenue, get some tax write-offs, and just do what we love. So if any of you are an entrepreneur by heart, check out that little weekly message, see what it says. And finally, some kind of deadline issues. Now that the big tax day is over, April 15th, the only real deadline to worry about the rest of this month is if any of you have an S corporation or employees, your payroll reports are due by the end of this month. Now, I actually had a phone call just this morning. So if folks, you have an S corp, listen up. For those S corp owners, remember, if you haven't made any income in your corporation yet and you haven't started payroll, you don't need to do a report this month. Let me repeat that. For those that started with an S corporation and you're just getting rolling, don't worry about doing an S corporation payroll report that's due in April, July, October, and then at the end of the year. But once you do start making money, if you make money these first 3 months of the year, we've got to make sure your payroll is completed. It's due by the 31st. Now, Cynthia Morales in our office is our payroll director. She helps clients all over the country with payroll. Give her a call. Call the main number. You know how to reach us if you're listening to the show. But check that out and get your payroll completed. Now, once you start doing payroll, you have to keep going. If you don't make money, then you still have to do the zero payroll report, which is a discounted fee to get that done. But give us a call if you need some help on that. It's due, again, in the next couple weeks, so don't miss out. Now, today is Open Forum Show, and I have got a lot of questions. Once a month, we do the Open Forum Show where I do my best to answer tax and legal questions. And if I can't find the answer, I will find it for you and report back to you via email or share it on next week's show. But it's kind of a break from the regular routine. Normally we have amazing authors and guests. I think they're amazing, and it helps me in my life. Last week we had Sharon Lecter, co-author of Rich Dad Poor Dad, and numerous books. You're just a phenomenal guest. Please check out that radio show from last week if you haven't had a chance. But today is Open Forum Show, so if you have a question, live callers get priority. Now Lisa's in the studio. We had, again, those computer freeze and some problems there initially, but she'll give us a heads up if there's someone in the studio. And if you call in, please do so. And the number's there on the link through the newsletter again. If you're listening in, you know how to reach us. So give us a buzz, and just live callers get priority. But I've got a lot of email questions, and we're going to jump into those shortly. But as with every week, I'd like to do a little random legal or tax tip. Today we have Lee Chen, the lawyer running the California office, amazing guy, does a little of everything and is a huge resource to clients all over the country. So I want to welcome Lee Chen to the show and see what he's got to share with us. Lee, welcome.
Hey, Mark. It's great to be on.
Well, thanks for being here. I love it. I'm always excited to hear the experiences you have during the week. You're usually fighting battles and going to court. It's a lot more exciting. I think that's what typically people think lawyers do every day, where me, I'm a lover, not a fighter. We're doing planning, not fighting. So it's kind of exciting to hear. Do you have any neat experiences this week you want to share with us and maybe give us a little tip?
Well, I want to inform your listeners today about some recent changes that have been made to the lending laws. As people have probably heard, you know, there was a huge issue with what lenders were doing, you know, back in the 2009, 2010, robo-signing and not getting back to people and foreclosing on people and all that stuff. Congress got together. They went through an overhaul, and a lot of these changes, they set up a new agency, okay, and a lot of these new changes to lending guidelines and what their requirements are and what they need to follow have recently come into effect this year. And for people who are familiar with this, this is, truth in lending laws, the Real Estate Settlement Procedure Act. There have been recent amendments to it that have been implemented. I just want to hit on some of the main aspects that may apply to, homeowners.
Yeah, that's a great point. It is a huge law. I know even many CPAs, lawyers, and professionals don't even want to read it. It's ugly, lots of provisions. So I'm glad you're here to distill it down to maybe a few key points that would help our listeners. That's great. Go for it. What do you think we should be looking for?
So they set up a new agency, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. A lot of this information can be found on their website. It's consumerfinance.gov. They are also the agency that if you have a problem with your lender or whoever's servicing your loan, you can complain to them. Okay, and they have authority to, they have regulatory authority over their member banks. But in fact, I had a person email me about this today where they have a servicer that's servicing their loan and they're not properly crediting payments or they're imposing fees that they're not supposed to impose. They are requiring them to get an escrow account when they don't need to do that. The new amendments to this law provides for specific guidelines on what a lender can do and cannot do. Okay, and this goes to servicing your loan. Okay.
So let me ask right now, where do people, I know you may get, I just want to ask right now, is there a phone number or a website that people should know where they can go to complain?
Well, if you go to consumerfinance.gov, you can, you know, they have a complaint section there where you can file your complaint. I believe you can even check complaints that have been made by other people as well. They have the information on this website in terms of what the new guidelines are. It is, of course, difficult to read. It is, pages and pages and pages. The website, you know, they have PDFs on there that are hundreds of pages. I mean, how are you supposed to understand that? So, what I wanted to do was give you some, and this may be a little legal, but give you some sites to where you can find the law if you're having problems with your lender. And when you go to the law, it's actually a lot more easier to look at than some of these summaries that they try to give you at the on the website.
So consumerfinance.org is where you would generally go, but you're saying it's difficult to navigate and hard to sometimes get a resolution. So you want to give us some other sites where if you're having problems with your lenders, this is where you go.
Yeah, it's consumerfinance.gov.
Consumerfinance.gov. Okay.
Yes. So if you're having a problem with your lender in terms of the servicer, they're not crediting your payments or they are charging you for stuff that they shouldn't be charging you for, there's a regulation that you can look up, and you can just Google it, or if you know how to do look up regulations, you can look it up. It's 12 CFR 1024.35. And if you Google that...
So repeat that one more time.
It's 12 CFR, okay, Charlie Frank Richard, 1024.35. That is the regulation, and if you just Google it, it'll direct you to the regulation. That's the regulation that governs... If the servicer made an error or something like that, what you can do and what your rights are in terms of trying to get them to fix it, okay? And there's timelines. They have to resolve it within 30 days. They have to give you a reason. And it also for people who were working with trying to get modifications and before and really sophisticated with that. You might have heard before about a QWR. It's called a qualified written request, where you can make a formal request with the lender for documentation on your loan. Okay, if they made a decision, we're not going to grant you a modification. You can ask them for documents in their possession, which they used to come to that decision. Okay, that site that I just gave you, 12 CFR 1024.35, is the current version of that rule that allows you to request documents from them. So if you want to get documents from them, go to that rule, and you'll find the legal regulation that requires them to do that.
Okay. Well, Lee, we've got a lot of questions today. This is a great little – it opens a whole can of worms. I'm glad that you bring up this topic. And I would suspect, too, a great place to start, again, is consumerfinance.gov. And if you're having problems with your loans, you can help guide people through maybe some of their options.
Absolutely. And that site gives you kind of the framework. Again, do everything in writing. Whenever you have a problem, start early. Don't wait. Don't sit on it. And make sure you document everything you send to the lender, every correspondence, every phone call you make. Document who you talk to that you sent it. Send things certified, fax, keep the fax cover sheet, etc.
Okay. I love it. Well, Lee Chen, thank you so much. Folks, if you want to get a hold of Lee, he's at L-E-E at K-K-O-S lawyers.com. That's Lee at K-K-O-S. LAWYERS.com. Lee, thanks for coming out on the show and sharing a little unique tip and something that a lot of people can find as a resource to help them with their loans.
Right. My pleasure, Mark, anytime.
Thank you. All right, well, folks, we're going to dive right into a litany of little questions here that I think many of you will find golden nuggets, something that can help you as well in your personal tax and legal planning. I'm grateful to be here with you. This is a fun show for me every month to do. Keeps me on my toes. I was just telling Lisa a moment ago in the studio, this is very nerve-wracking because I get very self-conscious that I'm going to hold it together during the show and hit all the questions. So let's go into it. We're just going to run with it, and we'll try to keep this lively and entertaining as well. So I got a question from Kathy. She says, Mark, can you please address how state income tax for rents are handled when the rentals are in a state other than the one you live in? Great show. Thanks so much, Kathy. Great question. And let me share a little point that many of you might find very interesting. And this relates directly to Kathy's question. When I was a brand new accountant, I worked in Portland, Oregon, for a couple accounting firms as I was getting my hours in order to take the CPA exam. Yes, this is about 12, 13 years ago. And I was putting in my time. Well, I was working at a large accounting firm where we worked on some of the Portland Trailblazer basketball players' tax returns. And when I worked in the actual state tax department, Kathy, so you this is right up your question. And I was a little surprised to see that these basketball players' tax returns were almost 4 inches thick. And I was like, I know they made a lot of money, but why is their tax return so thick? Well, the federal return was only 10 or 15 pages as usual, but it was all the state returns. So folks, did you not know, maybe you didn't know this, but when a basketball player in the NBA goes around the country and plays games, and they show up in Salt Lake City, Utah, or North Carolina, or you know, how many other states are they going to play? There are different basketball games. The state coming, when Kobe Bryant shows up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and plays his basketball game, Salt Lake says, hey, you can't show up in our state and play in our stadium and play basketball without sharing some of the revenue you're earning as a basketball player. And by the way, because you have endorsements with Nike and all these different clothing outlets or Gatorade or what have you, you need to share your revenue from your endorsements as well because they're endorsing you to play here in Salt Lake. So you have to take an NBA player's revenue and spread it out over multiple states based on the number of games they play throughout the year. It could also mean extra events or charity events or all sorts of weird things. So as you make money in other states, your income oftentimes has to be allocated to the state where you're making that money. Isn't that shocking? Well, this is for basketball players, baseball players, golfers, trucking companies, and rental properties. So folks, if you have a rental property in another state, when we complete your tax return, we're going to do a tax return for that state. So you're going to pay tax potentially in that state. Now, as you know, many of you know, with rental property, with depreciation, mortgage interest, and all the write-offs, you're probably not going to have taxable gain on a regular basis until you actually sell the rental property, because rental properties produce cash flow but not taxable income. But so, Kathy, this is very, very important because you do need to file tax returns in states where you have rental properties, but you and when you do have gain, when you sell the rental property, then you'll pay tax in that state, but in your home state, you will get a tax credit. So if I have a property in Arizona, it's in Arizona, back in California, I'll get a tax credit for any taxes I paid in Arizona, which will reduce my California tax. So you're not paying double state tax. But it's a pain, got to deal with it. So folks, keep in mind that your accountant needs to be on top of this. And this is, again, where as you buy more properties and then expand as an entrepreneur, TurboTax is something you're going to graduate from. Some of you could just knock out TurboTax with your W-2 and you're the small little family and no business. But once you start expanding and investing around the country, this is, again, where our accounting firm can hopefully be a huge benefit and resource to you. Okay, question from Jeff. He says, Mark, we have, or Geoff, I know Jeff, I apologize, forgive me if I didn't pronounce it right. This is G-E-O-F-F. I'm just going to say Jeff. Thank you. We have just bought a 24-foot Fleetwood Icon Class C RV as a mobile office for our new RV inspection business. It is titled to us personally. I know I can deduct mileage expense, but can I charge rent for the use of the mobile office? We will not be living in the unit unless I'm on location away from home. at the home base, and I use it as a quote-unquote hotel. I was thinking $500 a month would be reasonable rent to reimburse myself for insurance and loan payments. What are your thoughts? Well, Jeff, this is a great question. And for those that are in the RV inspection business with the Work Camper organization, I'm shooting some videos on this that you will find in your tax and legal video library. So this is a big topic. Jeff, please look out for those videos. They'll be coming out in the next few weeks. Many of you may already be a part of my tax and video library anyway. I'm constantly shooting new videos for this. This is one, Jeff. I'm just going to hit this quickly. I know many of you out there listening may have an RV work camping type business around the country. So here's the strategy. In this example, Jeff has a home base. He has a home. He jumps in the RV to drive out to go do work as an inspector or any sort of small business that might relate to his RV. But then he comes back home, he parks the RV in the garage, and lives in his home. So the RV becomes a business vehicle at that point. Now, this is you have a couple options, Jeff, to take the deduction here. Mileage actually would not be your best avenue, because with the RV as a business vehicle, we're going to depreciate the RV. We're waiting for more congressional updates on what that deduction is going to be this year. It was changed as of January 1st due to the fiscal cliff legislation. So be patient. But folks, this is much like an SUV, truck, RV. We want a delivery truck, something like that. We want to write that RV off in a more depreciated manner than just mileage. And Jeff, because it's a business vehicle and you're out driving around in it, we're going to take some of your travel costs, but not mileage. So we'll take fuel, repairs, maintenance, insurance, interest on the loan, if you bought it with a loan, and then that's your deduction. The home office is back at your home because you have a home. Remember, the RV is not your home. And because it's like a quote-unquote hotel for you, we'll be able to write off some of your food while you're traveling, but then the RV will be your business vehicle on the road. Again, look out for the video where I'll talk about this more in detail. Set up a consult if you'd like to talk about it more. But folks, exciting. Isn't that interesting? Many of you, hopefully, that have a truck, SUV, RV can deduct it in a more aggressive manner with that strategy. Now, if you're living in the RV as a full-timer and you don't have a home base, we're going to be sticking with mileage and a portion of the RV as home office. Whole other topic. Check out the video for the two options. Woo! Man, this is cranking away. Hope you guys are loving this. I'm just excited. This is a question from Deanna. She says, Mark, I just purchased your QuickBooks tutorial series. Oh, you rock. Thanks, Deanna. You're going to love it. I watched your two presentations, April 1st and 2nd. Now I want to access the presentations to study and review. How do I do that? Deanna. The best thing, and for anybody out there that's got the QuickBooks videos, let me just back up and say this. When you sign up for the QuickBooks videos, you're given a username and password. They are online, they're accessed online. So you'll log into a membership site, and you can watch the videos over and over again. There's 18 videos. So I'm not sure, Deanna, what you're referencing on April, quote-unquote, April 1st and 2nd, but all the videos are in there. They're not dated, per se. So make sure that you're accessing the right portal. And folks, let me just say this too. I am recording more videos. Literally, we just were slating them yesterday to be added to the QuickBooks video portal. We're going to be shooting QuickBooks videos on how to scan receipts, meet receipts, how to use your iPhone with QuickBooks, how to use the online version of QuickBooks because the screens look a little different. I'm reshooting a number of the screens that look a little hazy. So we're doing a ton. Once you buy it, you got it for life, and there's no additional fee. So keep that in mind, Deanna. Finally, if any of you are having problems with it, email Justin. Justin is my customer service director, just Justin, at markjkohler.com, or call the office and ask for Justin, and he'll resolve any username, password, access issues, or questions you have. Now, the next 3 days, he's at InfusionCon in Arizona. Some of you, I know, are listening from InfusionCon, exciting marketing conference down in Phoenix, Arizona. Infusionsoft is amazing. If you're a small business owner with client contacts, you may be at InfusionCon. Justin's down there, so if you do email Justin this week, know that he'll be returning emails from the from the workshop there or on Friday. So keep that in mind. So just be patient there. Okay, going down here through our next question. And folks, please email your questions in. I hope I can't see here on my iPad here how many questions. I may run out of questions. I may not get to all my questions. So please send in something if you have one. This is to Mark at markjkohler.com. I think many of you that have the newsletter or email know that. From Sergeant, he says, Mark, thank you so much for the open forum show. I have a question regarding property tax. Oh, this is a tough one. Property tax, I've fought these before, but they're always so tricky. Last year in 2013, I bought an investment property in Houston, Texas for $209,000, and I ran the comps. The current value of my house is not more than $245,000. But I got a letter from the Houston tax assessor that valued my house increased up to $265,000. My question is how to convince tax assessors that the value is wrong. Do I need to hire someone, or can I claim it and fight it by myself? So it's a great question. And for many of you out there, you may be getting these notices this time of year that your property's, what your property assessment is. Taxes are then due in the fall. So they kind of give you a six-month period from now until September or October to start to kind of fight these out. So, Sergeant, there is a very clear appeals process, and this is in every county in the country. You can appeal what the property tax assessment may be for your home or your rental property. So go to the county website or even look at your tax assessment notice, and there will be on the back or at the bottom or somewhere the appeals process. There's going to be deadlines involved, so you want to quickly get in, you know, find out what the deadline is and the rules are for making an appeal. I've actually gone and appealed some of my own properties before, and I've also represented clients to go appeal property tax assessments. Now, what you're going to want to do is... one of the best things you can do is pay for an independent appraisal. Get an appraisal of your property and use that as a major resource in your appeals process. Pull comps, very common. Go with as much ammo as you can. Now, keep in mind, if you bought it for something, that doesn't mean what it's worth. You may have got a good deal. And so the appraisal and what the other properties are valued at in the area is going to be what the county assessor is going to be looking at. If you find that you're getting hometowned or you can't represent yourself or go to the property tax hearing, sometimes they can do them via phone. Sometimes you can do it via writing and can hire a local, typically a CPA in the local area to represent you. Sometimes a surveyor or engineer is a great resource. Google, call people around and say, hey, who's a good one? Even call the county assessor's office and say, hey, who's some of the guys or gals that show up and help people with appeals? And they'll say, oh, Tom or Jed or Susan, they're always up here advocating for someone, and you might get a good reference by just calling the county assessor's office. But good question. Go for it, Sergeant. Good luck. I hope it comes together well for you. A question from Ray. He says, Mark, looking forward to your radio show today. As always, I have a short request for your radio show. I know a friend who is considering a short sale on his rental property, and I've been asked to provide some direction. In the past, you've mentioned a four-part decision matrix that provides some guidance on whether to keep the property or walk away. Excuse me. Would you mind taking a minute or two on your show today to review that? Well, thank you. That's a great question, Ray. Now, for some of you out there, I call this the Kohler Problem Property Matrix. Now, it's not because, now, yes, I have had problem properties myself, but I call it the Kohler Problem Property Matrix. And this is a little four-part grid, and I'm going to try to do this from memory, Ray. I've talked about it a lot and developed it, so hopefully I can do it justice here. But the thing, the trick is here is that you want to try to create a little grid. And I'm going to do it here on a little whiteboard here that's in front of me. Let me see if I can get this right. So you create a grid, and in the top left quadrant, let's put good cash flow. And then in the next grid down on the left, we'll put bad cash flow. And then at the top left, so go in the grid, so you're going to create like a square, you know, a line from top to bottom and then a line through it left to right. In the left quadrant is good cash flow. In the bottom left quadrant is bad cash flow. Then the from up above, you're going to come down and you're going to have good equity. And then, so that'll be column one going from top to bottom. And then column two from going to bottom, top to bottom, is bad equity. And so here's the deal. So with each property, you can determine what to do with it by just kind of analyzing here. So for example, if you have a property with good equity and good cash flow, so from top to bottom on the left, you have good equity, and from left to right at the top square, you have good cash flow, obviously you're going to keep that property. Duh, right? But then at the top right quadrant, you might have bad equity. The property could be totally upside down, but you have good cash flow. And I'm the type that says, but he's upside down and you're getting cash flow. That's to me as a keeper. So I put keep in the top right-hand column because what you got to lose? If you're making cash flow and the equity's upside down, just keep it. Someday it might turn around. Now in the bottom left-hand quadrant, you've got good equity but bad cash flow. Now this is the trickiest quadrant because some of you may say, well, Mark, this equity is there and the property is growing in value, so I'm willing to suck it up with the bad equity. Others of you, this is a key indicator to say, sell, let me harvest the equity. I can't keep up with this bad cash flow. And so that could be, now, typically if you have equity, short sale is not going to be happening because that would be a bad equity scenario. So you wouldn't need a short sale. But if you have decent equity and the equity is growing, you may want to deal with the bad cash flow. Think of it like a savings account. You're throwing money away, you may feel, but the equity is outpacing the loss in cash flow. So think about that. Now, in the bottom right-hand corner, you're dealing with bad equity and bad cash flow. And in that situation, pretty straightforward. Anyway, this has been something that I've used in the past to kind of bring clarity to the situation because it's so emotional, it's so hard when you've got a bad property and you're, you know, kind of freaking out. So it's difficult. So think about that. I know it can be challenging. Okay, so let's go over here to another question for today's show. This is from Cecilia. Mark, you've mentioned that I can't deduct travel costs incurred when shopping for a rental property unless I actually purchase it. We'll clarify that in a moment. But are there any other costs incurred as part of due diligence deductible even if I don't purchase? Broker's opinion, BPO, title search, appraisal. Love the show. Thanks so much. Well, Celia, that's a great question. Let me say this right now, that I would not consider a title search, appraisal fees part of a travel expense because those are real hard costs that you are incurring with the hopes of buying a property. So I would absolutely deduct those. What the IRS is concerned about for all of us out there listening here is that if you jump in a plane, go to get a hotel, have food, and run over to Hawaii or some, you know, generally luxury location and say, oh, I'm shopping for rentals, I want to write off my trip. Or maybe it's a trip to the middle of the breadbasket of America to go visit grandma, and you're trying to write off trips to grandma, but you're going to look at properties while you're there. That's where I have a hard time with those travel costs, food, dining, hotel, airfare, rental cars, because you never really bought anything. But if you're out there, and one other thing to clarify in Cecilia's comment is if you're shopping for rentals and you didn't purchase it, I mean, you may look at 10 properties and then come back a second time and buy a, you know, property number 15, something you didn't look at on your first trip. Then I'm willing to go back and write off maybe a good portion of both trips because the trip shopping resulted in a purchase. So keep track of all those expenses. We never know if a purchase could ultimately come together, even if it's months later. And the last thing is any hard costs you incur, legal, accounting, appraisal, realtors, things like that related to a property, oh my gosh, write those off. Those I would not include as in the travel bucket. To me, those would be very different. So think about that. So good point for everybody this summer as you're making travel plans to maybe look around for a rental property in a particular area. Okay, Carol. Boy, now I can see this one's going to be a tough one. Carol says, she says, hey, Mark, can political organizations purchase an online site for their members, friends, and family to use, and the organization receive the commissions as fundraising? There are no products for the organization to handle. The product is travel, which is on the site. The political organization just advertises the site to their members. They're concerned about government regulations for a political group like Republican Executive Committee, REC, or the Democratic Executive Committee, DEC. I was going to continue to read the question here, but I'll just say this, Carol. I am not up to speed on political organization PAC money and some of the rules related to that. Let me see if I can get you an answer. I will do my best, but this is a tricky one. So please re-email me if I don't get back to you in the next few days or week, and let's see if we can try to get you an answer to this, or at least I'll give you a resource of where to find the answer. The very tricky question. So for some of you wanting to confirm if I am truly and don't claim to be all-knowing, there was the question that proved it. So very difficult question. I apologize, Carol, for not being able to answer that. Oh, now we get a good one. This is from Dustin. Dustin says, hey, Mark, question regarding mileage. Love this. Is the mileage calculated in total round-trip miles? For example, I have a photography company, and for a photo shoot, I leave my house, go to the location 10 miles away. We then go to a second location 5 miles away. And once we are done with the shoot, I drive home 15 miles to my house from the last location of the shoot. When I do my mileage, can I calculate total miles of 30, or am I only restricted to the 15 miles, 10 plus 5 it took me to get to the shoots, and not what it took me to get home? Clarification would be great. Love the show and appreciate the open forum. Oh, thanks so much, Dustin. Okay. This is great for everyone. See, this is where these questions from our wonderful listeners around the country can help all of us. This is a great question. Dustin, you're going to love the answer. It's round trip, baby. It's all doing business because you had to get there and you had to get home. So you incurred an expense to get to the business location and the expense to get back home. So I would take the round trip mileage, love it, 30 miles, no problem. Now, a couple other ancillary points that I think might help some of you out there is this is why I love the home office deduction. Because if you do have a home office for one or more of your businesses, every time you jump in the car and leave and go to have a lunch meeting, go to a workshop, meet with a client, meet with a vendor, go do an actual project like this photo shoot example, as soon as you leave, it's business mileage until you get back. Now, technically, if you stop doing business in the middle of the day and drive 30 miles to go golfing and then 30 miles back home, you know, that little portion would not be deductible. But again, if you're golfing, shouldn't you be golfing with someone that is a potential client or partner, business, joint venture, vendor, customer? Who knows? Make sure your entertainment is in that mix too, so we can make sure the whole trip for your mileage. So anyway, I love it. I'm going to be launching a new phone app soon that you can download on your phone and track your mileage via satellite. So those types of apps are out there already, but I'm bringing it all together in one comprehensive app that you can track expenses, take pictures of receipts, and track your mileage. You're going to love it. Hopefully we'll be launching that very, very soon. Great question, Dustin. Okay, now over here to Diane. This is a fun question. I love this. I saw this before. This is on the inheritance. So Diane asks, I inherited some rental farmland that I inherited from my sister. Sorry about your sister's passing. We currently hold and operate it as an LLC partnership. What is the best way to pass it on to family? Keep it in an LLC or form a limited partnership? We'd like to pass it on to the family and avoid estate taxes. The total current value of both shares is $1.2 million. Okay, so and she's got a second question here. Let's deal with this one first. So folks, a few important points, and Diane, keep this in mind. Your entire estate exemption, when you pass on, is $5 million, and your family gets a stepped-up basis to the fair market value. So this is something you have to kind of do the math and look at your overall estate value. If this rental farmland is one of the primary assets in your portfolio and there's not much else, maybe a home, a little bit of life insurance, and you're still under $5 million, we don't need to get more aggressive with any planning. The best way to pass it to your family is through a family trust that owns the LLC. So in the trust, you can designate who inherits your portion of the LLC, and the trust can delineate that, especially if you have minor children, grandchildren, things like that. The trust is a great way to do it. It is true inside the LLC agreement you could have some sort of buy-sell provision, but the ultimate inheritance issue is generally taken care of in your estate, which is a will or a trust. So keep it in an LLC and just make sure the two shares are owned by a trust agreement and that the LLC references the trust agreements and says, here's what happens if one family dies or the other family, and here's where it goes, and here's how it stays in the family or whatever. One kind of a buy-sell agreement in the LLC and the family trust would bring this whole thing together. And again, for everybody out there, you do not pay estate tax if the picture of what you're worth when you die is less than $5 million. Okay, also, she says, my husband and I have a vacation condo in Maui, and we own, did I say that weird, Maui? Sorry. Also, my husband and I have a vacation condo in Maui that we own with four other families in a joint tenancy agreement. What advantages, disadvantages would there be of putting this property in an LLC? The owner thought his share would be harder to sell. Should we form an LLC with our 20% share? Current value is about $120K, and we want to pass it on to family. Okay, now, an LLC is critical for several reasons. First of all, the guy that wants to share his, maybe sell his one-fourth share, it's going to be hard to sell that, whether it's in an LLC or not. Seriously, someone comes up to me and goes, hey, do you want to buy a fourth of my condo? I'm going to say, who are the three other partners? And actually selling that share in an LLC makes it very, very easy because ownership only needs to be transferred through a membership transfer agreement. You don't have to do a title closing or title policy. The title policy would be held in the LLC. And then you want an LLC also because do you want to be personally liable? Say your home in your little town of Nebraska or Arizona or wherever you live. Sorry, Diane. And then one of your partners is over in the condo in Maui, and they throw a huge party, and someone drowns in the pool or falls off a balcony and gets killed. Who are they going to sue? They're going to sue all the owners of the property, even if you weren't there, because you should have known better to have better railings or, you know, some sort of disclosure or something regarding the risks of the property and where this accident occurred. So an LLC gives all four owners asset protection from the actions of their other partners. And number two, if any partner wants to sell, they can easily sell their portion of the LLC much easier than selling the actual title of ownership. And number three, you've got your ownership of the LLC owned by your family trust. So if you pass on, your family steps right into the shoes of the LLC. If not, you've got to do a probate on your one-fourth interest of the property. I mean, Diane, there are about probably 10 other reasons, too, that an LLC would make more sense. Get all the partners on a phone call. Give me a buzz. We would love to help knock that out. Everybody knows this. We charge $800, all the attorney times included. The only extra cost would be a filing fee to get it done. So think about it. I think many of you may have found that point helpful if you have joint ownership in any sort of property like that. Okay, we've got another Dustin here with a question. He says, hey, Mark, the same Dustin here. He's got a second question if you get to it on today's show. I'm just taking these as they come, so first come, first serve. We're going to give it a shot. These may be, I'm going to paraphrase these. This is a little longer. So he says, again, I have a photography company, but this question is regarding property writing off advertising conference expenses. First, he says, if I go out of town and take professional photos of landscape, can I write off the travel lodging costs associated with the trip as advertising? I would not be getting paid for that particular trip, but I want to take pictures and then use them for advertising. Dustin, that's a little aggressive. You've got to be careful. I think anybody out there listening to the show, if you have a small business and you're trying to write off advertising trips that you're doing to advertise by taking pictures that you're going to show off, if your photography business is robust enough and it really does help you bring in new business, and that people go to that location and it helps, that could be a possibility. Your accountant, if we're your accountant, Dustin, we get into it a little more detailed and understand what your revenue model looks like, what your advertising budget looks like, and what your advertising and business normally comes in. Be careful out there. The next part is related to conferences. Same scenarios above in regards to write-offs, except I would be working out a deal with a conference that I'm going to. Okay, now we're talking business. Because if you can, Dustin, go to a conference as part of a business trip and then take some pictures while you're there, better yet. Now I'm loving it. Now we can write off travel, dining, hotel, air, rental car, whatever, because you're there for a business training meeting, and you're taking pictures, and you may be meeting with customers. Again, folks, the more reasons you can find for a business trip, the more I'm going to be apt to feel comfortable writing it off. Next question from Mary Jo. She says, can dental expenses be paid through our LLC, if not through an S-Corp? Are there any tax savings worth it? Need expensive dental work and would like to choose the least expensive way to do so. Woo! Okay, Mary Jo, this is a big question. I would highly recommend you look at my book, What Your CPA Isn't Telling You, which I know here from your signature, you've got that book. Look at the a section on healthcare. It's in the appendix. And also, I've shot some videos on this in the Tax and Video Library. And I'm shooting an updated medical video this year to deal with Obamacare and how it's evolving this year. So I'm going to be shooting a couple videos on that. So any of you that are on my Tax and Video Library network, these videos are for you to watch and get updated. And once you're a part of it, you never pay again. You get these little updates. Go to markjkohler.com to pick those up, folks, if you haven't already. So Mary Jo, you're going to want to read more up on this. I can't answer this all on the show, but let me just give you a couple quick answers that might be helpful and point you in the right direction. You have two main options, health savings account or health reimbursement arrangement. If you have an LLC or an S-Corp, the health savings account is separate from that. It's going to be way easy to implement. It's based on your age, and do you have a high deductible insurance policy? You can look at the details of that in the appendix and the grid of on what your CPA isn't telling you as to what the HRA, HSA, and how they interrelate. But the health savings account is where you would make a deposit into the HSA, get a tax write-off, and let your HSA pay for your dental work. So that's option one. Option two for anybody out there with some extra medical expenses is to do a health reimbursement arrangement, HRA. Now, in an LLC, what that would entail is you would hire your spouse to work for the business and then give them a health reimbursement arrangement and cover all their health care. So your husband could hire you or you hire your husband, and then it includes their dependents, which would be either one of you, and the HRA is a great way to do that. The LLC actually is easier for that, and I think, Mary Jo, you have an LLC, and the S-Corp is maybe coming down the road. So if you have a lot of dental, the HRA is the way to go. We use TASC Online for that, TASCOnline.com. That's T as in Tom, A as in Apple, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, online.com. Go to the Small Business Network HRA plan. You sign up for about $400. You sign up for it. You adopt the plan. You can get it going. Give us a call. We can help walk you through it. And you can get a tax write-off for all the dentals. So great little question. Okay. Gosh, we are just plugging along here. Lots of good questions here. Let's see where we're at next. Okay. Woo, I think we're going to be just right. We've got about 12 minutes left and a few more questions here. Hello, Mark. This is from Keith. He says, how do we cancel a single-member LLC that you set up for us 5 years ago to hold rental properties? We now have only one rental property in the LLC, and the associated costs aren't worth it. The admin cost of filing the annual report, cost of filing a separate tax return, and the state LLC fee. We need to remove the property from the LLC in order to refinance at a lower interest rate as well. Well, obviously, this is probably a California LLC. For any of you that have rental property in California, you're right. The two or three rentals makes great sense for an LLC. Maybe one rental, the cost of an LLC can be a little exorbitant, and you can go to a get double insurance with some sort of umbrella policy, get a good rental policy, maybe even triple up on insurance, which could be even cheaper than having an LLC. That in mind. His initial question is, how do I cancel a single-member LLC? Now, keep in mind, you don't really have a separate tax return for a single-member LLC. You just have a state tax return, and that may be what you're referring to, Keith. But the way you dissolve, the word you want to use, dissolve or dissolution, articles of dissolution, and because we're right now in the month of April for the year, your LLC is going to be good through the rest of the year. That $800 filing fee for California, you had to have paid in the last week, and it was due April 15th, and then it's going to cover you for the whole year. So maybe just keep the property in there. Take it out, do your refi, put it back in the LLC, get the protection for this year. But by December, make sure you file articles of dissolution. Susan Compey in my office, our paralegal, can take care of that. You're looking at about $100 OR fee and then a local and then a filing fee. But it's very affordable. It's called articles of dissolution. You could do it yourself. But you're pretty much stuck for the LLC for this year. So you want to dissolve it in December so that come January 1st, it's gone. So you may be a little upset, kicking yourself, going, darn, I should have dissolved this 4 months ago. But you kind of got it for the year, so you're kind of stuck there for now. Okay, so let's see another question here. This is from Garnick. In our family, I have 3 irrevocable trusts from parents and own family's revocable trust that needs to be reviewed and updated. What is the best way to start? Well, I think this is a good question for everybody to hear. If you've got 3 irrevocable trusts from parents, Garnick, one of the first things I would do is just determine, are those necessary? Is it something you inherited from these family members? Are they passed on? When does the irrevocable trust terminate? The cost to maintain an irrevocable trust can be a little cumbersome. There's accounting processes necessary, trustee fees possibly. You've got to do a 1041 tax return. Now, again, these irrevocable trusts may not be, they could be defective trusts, meaning that they don't file tax returns. I'm not sure. So the first thing to do, Garnick, is to start with a review. Pay for one of the attorneys at our office. Probably me would be, I would be a good fit because I do so much trust work in this irrevocable trust area. I know Lee Chen, who is our expert tipster this morning on the show, Lee would be a great fit as well. He's across the hall from me. He works on a lot of trusts. So Lee Chen or myself, have us review. Send over a PDF copy of the trust. Have us look at it. Give us a little bio on what's going on, why you need these trusts, why they're there, and then present your concerns in an email. So hours time, we could be very efficient so that we keep your legal costs down. Now, for anybody out there that has an estate plan, maybe you did a trust or a will 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and you're thinking, oh, my gosh, I got to get this thing reviewed, it can be very affordable and simple. In fact, you can even start with, in your situation, Garnet, it's a little more complex because they're irrevocable trusts. But for anybody listening today, start with Julie Deck. Julie Deck is our estate planning paralegal. She's amazing. You could send over your estate plan, scan it in, PDF, whatever, send it to her, put it in a box, mail it to her, and say, Julie, look at this. Does this look normal? She'll do kind of a paralegal review. It can be very affordable, $100 or so. Then she can hand it off to an attorney for anything more extensive than that. So check that out. And I think that could be a really good fit. Okay, got a question from David here. So if my parents are getting a lump sum of money from a settlement and are willing to give me a 6-figure amount, is there a way to structure that income through my business to lower my tax liability this year? Well, oh my gosh, David, I am so glad you asked this. First of all, for anybody out there, if a parent or a family member is going to, quote unquote, give you money, that's a gift, and you don't pay tax on it. So, David, you're not going to be paying income tax on that. So the last thing I would want to do is funnel it through your business. I want to make sure that your personal return doesn't even reflect that as an income. So any gift you receive is non-taxable. Now, the second problem, however, is that there are limitations on how much your parents can give you. The gift tax exemption this year, it always changes. I think it's been adjusted for inflation this year. It's 14. Forgive me, 14 grand. If someone, there's so many numbers going through my head on a show like this, but I think it's up to 14 grand. It could be 15 or 13, but I believe it's 14,000. Just Google 2014 gift exemption amount. Your parents can only give 14,000 per person. So they could give you 28 grand, for example, if it's 14. And if you were married, then they could double that because they could give, you know, you 14, your mom could give you 14, then give your spouse 14, and then then vice versa, your dad to you and your spouse. So now we're up to 54,000. So 56,000. So you could do 28 times 2. So now we're to 56 grand. So if they want to give you a 6-figure gift, and not pay gift tax. They typically have to file a tax return for that, and it's called a gift tax return. Now, they don't pay tax. They just use up some of their lifetime gifting exemption. So talk with the CPA so that your parents don't pay tax and you don't pay tax. And they may not even be paid tax on this settlement as well. I don't know if it's from a wrongful death, an injury of some sort. So look for just get a CPA consult, and we can help you with that in a little more in-depth manner. So great question. This is from Carl. He says, I'm getting my real estate. I need an entity. I have heard you say S-Corp, and I have heard others in my investing community say LLC. I am currently working to acquire property via short sale with a partner, and we will fix and flip. Should I use an S-Corp or an LLC? Can I start with an LLC, and then as I get more deals, change it to an S-Corp? Well, Carl, these are all excellent questions, and this is what we would cover in a consultation. It's very common that an LLC is going to be used for rentals. The S-Corp would be used for your fix and flips. So you want to find, in a consultation, we would look at what your overall income looks like, what other income you might have, are you married, single, and then come up with the best recommendation for you. But you're definitely on the right track doing something such as that. So be thinking as a consult where we could get into the details, and I think a LLC for that can be converted to S-Corp is always a great fit. Sorry for the little delay there. One other thought on that too is if you've got a day job, you're going to graduate into the S-Corp a little slower. For those out there that are realtors, contractors, developers, things like that, the S-Corp is more of a priority. So, Carl, set up that consult. As I mentioned a little earlier in the show, you get all the attorney support you need, maybe an hour to an hour and a half or whatever it could take with one of our attorneys for that $800 fee. We could review your tax return in the process and really kind of look at your comprehensive plan for the year. And it really will make your life a lot more, a lot easier by getting that consultation. Okay, this may be our last question of the show. I'm going to try to hammer this out in about a minute and a half. He says, this is from R. You can give me his phone. He says, I have some land that we own free and clear that is currently in escrow. It is held in tenants and we're looking to do a 1031 exchange into different properties. Do we need to purchase as a previous TIC, or can we create another entity to purchase still 1031 exchange, da-da-da-da-da? With our last minute here, this is a very difficult question to answer with a 1031 exchange. Let me just say, if you have a 1031 held in a TIC, that's tenant in common, you can look at different properties in the future and maybe sell one property, buy three. We're going to have to look at the structure of ownership, but a 1031 is very doable, and you probably wouldn't do an entity until the 1031 is done. So, folks, 1031s are getting more and more popular. Don't pay the tax. Roll the property into the next one. So, folks, wow. Okay, lots of questions there. Now, don't turn off yet. Let me make a couple of quick notes. Woo! Thank you for listening. This is an exciting opportunity every month to do the open forum show. And please note that in 2 days is my monthly online webinar. That's the Strategic Wealth Alliance webinar. It's this Wednesday night, 23rd at 6 p.m. Pacific. You can sign up on my website, $20, and I get a new topic every month. This month's scam. So scams to avoid. Folks, looking forward to being with you in the future, and thank you for listening in. We'll see you next week. Mark Kohler Show at 11 a.m. Pacific.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.